Welcome to the Lights Out Podcast. This is Chris Lights Out Lytle, and this is our journey to document the history of mixed martial arts. I have brought with me my friend, the MMA detective Mike Davis, and together we will preserve the history and hear some great stories from the world in the era of the no holds barred. Thank you and enjoy.
Welcome back to the Lights Out MMA History Podcast. I am Joey Venti. I'm with the host of the show, the MMA detective Mike Davis. Our guest today is a true pioneer of the sport who fought in the no-holds-barred era. He's a champion of a one-day Super Brawl heavyweight tournament, as well as a veteran of the International Valet Tudo Championships and the UFC. He had a wild career, which included some very big names. We are excited to catch up with Bob Gilstrap. Bob, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
So, Bob Gilstrap, first off, ladies and gentlemen, we're doing this at an hour where Bob's children or mine are going to be prevalent in the background. Let's just apologize ahead of time. The only one that's got his house in order is Joey. That's
I got a 4 and a 5 year old running around out there. Hopefully they stay out there.
Right. And not out there. Right. Yeah, right. Right. They're in the house. So Bob, obviously UFC 17 was when the country first learned of you. But let's start from the beginning. Where did your beginnings in mixed martial arts start?
All right. So I guess my story is I kind of grew up a short, little, fat, funny kid. I got picked on a lot. That kind of stuff. Kind of had the old like man crush on Bruce Lee. I'm like, no one picks on Bruce Lee. Not man crush, but, you know, just, yeah, oh, that's the tough guy, you know. Went through high school, my junior, senior year, let's put it in perspective, from the fifth grade to through my professional career, I weighed 220 pounds. I just wasn't as tall as that in the fifth grade. So I was a short little chunky kid. And then it kind of, my junior year grew into it. After high school, I got into Taekwondo and some other stuff to pursue martial arts, kind of, you know, Red Jeet Kune Do, went through the Bruce Lee stuff as much as I could. Did not fare well in a point system martial art type venue because it comes, that's where I first was introduced to like physics, you know, smaller guys are faster. That's all there is to it. They're going to hit you more times. They're going to hit you faster. I just hit harder. So I left point stuff, started looking for some full contact, was turned away from a couple of boxing gyms, found Maurice Smith, and that's where it started. So,
well, that's a hell of a starting line, Maurice Smith.
Yeah,
it really is. So was this Maurice Smith at the time of the Alliance or a pre-Alliance Maurice Smith?
This was a pre-Alliance Maurice Smith. This was pre-UFC Maurice Smith.
There wasn't
even a UFC created yet. Now, of course, fighting has been in the top three sports outside of the United States for millennia. It's just here in America, we didn't talk about it really until about 2006, until Dana put it on Spike. You know what I mean?
Joey, I think you'll agree with me. Like, we caught the three of us. I mean, we all caught the MMA bug really, really early.
Real early.
Absolutely. Yeah. And when going to a party with friends and family, were you ever asked by like parents not to talk about MMA because it was just such a, like a topic that was pretty heavy and people would be like, what is going on here?
No, I come from a pretty ignorant family. And so when, you know, kind of rednecky, you know, our family tree is straight up and down. So when I'd get to talking about MMA, I'd get a lot of, oh, you mean WWF? Oh, you mean wrestling? And I'm like, no, we do it for real. They're like, oh, you mean WWE? And I'm not taking anything from those athletes because those guys, they take a beating. But it's prearranged versus ours. We're all trying to be the winner.
Well, Joey, like, and to add to that, they would say, Oh, yeah. Like real. Like, real. Real. Joey, did you get that as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. In the like early dark days. Yeah. People didn't believe it was real.
Yeah. And it's like, oh, it's not scripted. Okay. Yeah. You're keeping a secret. You know, you're keeping the industry secrets.
Yeah, we're marks.
So, Bob, the one thing that your era of NHB, your first fight's in 1997. But the one thing that I like, you're part of the generation, like the headbutt generation, as well as the generation that paid to fight or fought for free.
Right. And that is a hard road to travel.
Right.
We didn't
have, and
go ahead.
There's a certain type of individual that like I've come to realize that would pay to fight. And generally they're, and I'm not saying this applies to you, but the home life growing up is pretty tumultuous. Like it's pretty, there's a lot of waves.
I mean, even when I had my gym, jump forward 20 years later, you know, you're giving rich happy kids don't get into MMA unless you're BJ Penn. You know what I mean? Like if BJ comes from good money, you know, but most people are looking for a way out. They're looking for a vacation. They're looking somewhere to channel their negativity. You know, the kids that came to my gym, again, they're looking for an opportunity. You know, they see these limelight guys, McGregors and stuff like that on the UFC and talked about. But until recently, we didn't make any money, and they don't get it, man. When you're going out in these, even today, you're lucky to get 300 to show and 300 to win. Like it might cover your expenses to get there or something.
Well, when I try to describe this like accurately to people so they can wrap their head around it, I said, would Sean Strickland fight for free? And they say, oh, yeah. Would Sean Strickland pay to fight? Oh, for sure. Now imagine an entire event, you know, maybe not with his skills or athleticism, but that type of personality was the entire locker room.
Right. And I came, and we'll probably get into this, I came out of retirement because I had a gym going and my students kind of talked me into it. Not a great idea. Fight at 39, 40, and 41. Didn't win one of those. It's a younger guy's sport, man. But, you know, the leading killer over men over 40 is their ego. So,
truth. It's not truth to that. It's not truth.
Right. So, just these kids are softer now. I mean, like even my students would complain. They'd want to like Facebook stalk these guys or look them up. You know, we didn't have those options. You know, people get on me about not having all my fights on the computer. You know, well, I used to have to lug around my own VHS recorder and put it on a tripod and talk somebody into videotaping my fights, you know. And these kids will stalk people and, oh, I don't want to fight that guy. Back in my day, you know, my coach would come to me and go, hey, you ready to fight? Doesn't matter who's across the ring. We were just all tougher back there. And the pioneers, the guys I fought up in Canada, you know, Jason, all those guys, you know, great dudes. They didn't make it as far as I did, but they didn't get the recognition. But, you know, we were all just tough, tough kids.
You guys not only did you not have an avenue to fortune, but there really wasn't an avenue to fame either. Like UFC 17, they weren't selling a ton of pay-per-views.
No. And it was a legal way for us to vent our traumatic childhoods out in an athletic manner. You know what I mean? I guess. I mean, everyone's got their own reasons, but.
Beats going to jail, I guess.
Ed Beats going to jail.
And you know, like that, the type of mentality also was, well, if I'm in the gym and fighting, like, on all of the weekends, it keeps me like out of trouble, keeps my lady off my back and money outside of the bar and still in my pocket. So it was just a very unique time. So January 11th, 1997, United Full Contact Federation. That's Matt Hume's organization, I believe. Yep. Your first opponent is Chris Munson. Were you still with Maury Smith at this time, or had your training room brought it?
We all started in the same gym. We all started. Matt Hume was the very first person that ever showed me any kind of grappling, and he showed Maurice as well. Maurice and Haru had AMC kickboxing there in Kirkland, Washington. And later, all through the amateurs and stuff, we were all together. And then we split due to management reasons. I followed Maurice, and Matt Hume's fighters were next, pretty much our rivalry. And Chris Munson was first on deck in that lineup.
Chris Munson was fighting with Charlie Pearson at this time, I believe. Am I correct?
Oh, yeah, you're correct. You're correct. I'm sorry. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Another legendary trainer still around. Ton of history. You know what? Joey, we got to get him on. Charlie Pearson is somebody we absolutely should concentrate on getting on here. So, Chris Munson, it's your first fight. Bring us through it, dude. This is the era of the headbutt. So it's a different type of athlete entering into these things.
Yeah, it was my opportunity to go out and use everything that I had been taught in a malicious manner. Because you don't let go in practice like that. You're not looking for the win. Well, in practice, you're looking for the sub, but you're not looking to hurt anybody. MMA just gave me an opportunity to just unleash all the years of bullshit I had stored up in my pocket. So Munson got the abuse of that, and I think there was some headbutts in there. But I just went out and kind of let everything go. I am one of the worst wrestlers on the planet. I have no takedown defense, so there's my secret. Not so much of a secret. I love the stand and bang, though. I love trading that with people. And then once we get to the ground, which most people would get me to the ground, I felt pretty comfortable once we were down there. I just didn't have the good knees. So me and Munson ended up on the ground, and I can't remember everything. I think we rolled around a little bit. I think I ended up on top and threw some stuff and went into the next round, and Munson was a great athlete, and he was super strong.
Big guy, huge guy. Yeah.
But I don't think most of the guys that I fought didn't like my power. Once I started unloading punches, that was what gave me my competitive edge.
Okay.
I think.
Yeah. So you mentioned Matt Hume being the first person to actually show you what submissions are. Where do you surmise Matt Hume's like information in regards to submissions came from at this point?
To me, it was guessing. Because he came on as a coach at a coach level. So him and Maurice and management would talk about that kind of stuff. I was the only kid big enough in the school that Maurice could beat up on, Matt could beat up on, and another one of my buddies, John Renfro, could beat up on and not complain. So I was their dummy. I pretty much just laid there and let Matt would show how to throw the stuff. Then Mo would go because, it was all about teaching Mo. And John was just a really big, muscle guy and heavyweight as well. So another training partner for Mo. So it was all about Matt spreading his knowledge to Maurice. And I was just lucky enough to be in the right spot at the right time. But Matt had experience from Pancras. I think he was over in Japan. I don't know for how long he was over in Japan. I met Matt actually a year or two before that. A little known secret about Matt. Matt used to be a cobbler. He worked in the Fred Meyer working on shoes, and I ran an espresso bar in a Fred Meyer. So this was before AMC, before all that. So going way back.
Yeah, Matt's one of those guys. I ran into him in Colorado.
Uh-huh.
And there's like a short list of people that I would 100% come across as a fanboy douchebag to. And Matt is probably at the top of that list, but I controlled myself and just asked a couple dorky questions. Like it was just a, you know, happenstance. Right. And then went on my way, never got a picture, which I've always wanted, you know, nor did I ask him for his phone number for an interview. So yeah, it was in Denver, Colorado when One FC was out there. So yeah.
Matt is an amazing, good thing. Matt is amazing coach, amazing person. I just got caught up in a rivalry between two gyms that I didn't start. So
that's what makes good fights. I mean, let's call it what it is.
Well, I mean, even to this day, and meeting people outside of the fight industry, they don't know how to take us because, like, I pretty much all my best friends and including myself, like, we've all punched each other in the face, and people are like, huh? Like I don't have a good friend that I haven't punched in the face. You know what I mean? Or that has punched me in the face.
Something's transpired. Yeah. On the front lawn, in a bar, house party.
Something has happened at some point somewhere, and we're good with that. You know what I mean? That's why I love fighters. Fighters are the most upfront, honest people you ever meet. Because what's the outcome of a negative conversation? An argument? Where's that lead? A fight? Fuck, that's practice.
Right. So the Pacific Northwest at this time, like, and Joey's a California guy, I'm a Midwest guy, but like, if you were to like pinpoint just hotbeds where incredible athletes came from, the Pacific Northwest, based on, you know, this sparse population, wouldn't be one of those places. But the athlete that came out of there, Dennis Hallman, Benji Raddick, Ivan Salivary, Matt Hume, Josh Barnett, like the list goes on and on and on, where it's Landon Showalter. I mean, that's just off the top of my head.
Yeah.
The amount of athlete coming out of there, it's shocking just how far, like that little scene right there, just like, I guess how up on the food chain that they actually were.
Right. Between Matt Hume, Maurice Smith, and up north, Charlie Pearson, and us three gyms competing against each other, honing skills and going up into Canada and all the Canadians beating on us or taking a licking. We were like the underrated, in my opinion, back then, they were very much underrated state that because a lot of talent came out of Washington.
And keep in mind, that's just Washington. I mean, yeah. Oregon also falls into that category.
Team Quest. Yeah.
And I have not mentioned a single member of Raw or Team Quest.
Right.
Think about that. That's the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
Yeah. So your first airplane ride, which, I mean, this is one of those benchmarks that you have to have. April 9th, 1997, a legendary tournament in Super Brawl 4. So Super Brawl 4 was headlined by Danny Boy Bennett and J.R. Palmer, which J.R. Palmer is on caught a 14-fight win streak. They brought you and Danny Boy Bennett up there as just cannon fodder because no one would fight J.R.
Well, yes, it was, again, I think Matt had ties to Hawaii. So I got invited over for three, actually, where my buddy, and I cornered my buddy John Renfro, who lost to Pete.
I'm Williams. Blankers.
Yep. Thank you, Jerry. And then real quick, and we were over there, and that's the first time Danny Boy knocked out J.R. Palmer. So was at three. And that was the legendary head kick around the world. One of the best, if you haven't seen it, one of the best head kicks you'll ever see. Danny Boy's interview afterwards, like, I thought I killed him. I mean, the dude looked dead. I mean, from the moment the shin touched his chin, the way he fell out of the ring, he didn't wake up for a while. I mean, it was amazing. And that started that. And then four, I got invited over. So it was my turn to compete, which was cool. And so I was in the heavyweight bracket. Danny Boy had the rematch against J.R. Palmer, and Leonard Carter, who was out of Danny Boy's gym, and again, another cross-trained partner of ours, had the middleweight bracket.
Wait, real quick. the rematch with Danny Boy Bennett, because J.R. Palmer was just, I mean, it was a fluke what took place there.
Oh, yeah.
What happened in the rematch?
The exact fucking same thing. It wasn't as cool the way he passed or went down the second time, but same shit, different day. Beautiful.
So just so kind of everybody understands, like, Matt Hume is an evil genius. Like, he is somebody that can kind of look at a style and just go, all right, let me get you a 2-7 guy. Don't worry. This guy, he's just going to come in, you know, as your body. And that 2-7 guy will match up in a way where it'll beat like that hometown person. This was kind of Matt Hume's, I think, knocking on the door of being able to consistently do that. So you just kind of, you know, got to sit back and just avoid Matt Hume altogether if he's going to be matchmaker filling spots for your hometown guys. Right. So talk about Super Brawl 4, absolute legendary tournament. You start with John Matua and Lance Gibson. Those are your two opponents. Four-man tournament.
So at weigh-ins, Maurice, my coach, was held up with a fight of his own. So I flew out there with Matt Hume and Lance Gibson, and me and Lance were in the same bracket. So that was awkward. There was tension there. I hadn't seen Matt in quite some time. So me and Matt were kind of talking, but you know, Lance was his fighter. So we get over there and we kind of had to hang out. And that's a whole story in itself, prepping up to the fight. But once we got to the fight, you know, Maurice had shown back up. We get to weigh-ins. John Matua's flight didn't come in. So all I knew about John Matua was his weight. And I was scared to death. I thought he was looking like a bigger version of Chris Munson or Jeff Munson, sorry. When I finally got to see John Matua, that was when we both came out to the ring. And so he wasn't built the way I thought. And I was immediately going, okay, I'm like, I got to choke this big guy. So we started out there and I thought, you know, hey, he's huge. He's going to have a lot of power. The one gift I think I had in all my training camps and why Maurice later created the Alliance and the Shamrocks and so much talent came to Maurice Smith to learn how to stand up and fight was, no one in any fight ever hit me harder than Mo did in practice. You know, I was just conditioned. I mean, unless you got a lucky, you know, in my later career, my neck wasn't all there. So I got some knockouts, but I mean, very, very seldom could anybody bring something to me that Mo hadn't already hit me with. So once I started exchanging with Matua, I got real comfortable. He wrapped me up. I don't know what he was necessarily trying to do, but then we fell to the ground. I luckily got on top and went for some strikes. We got caught up in the cage or in the ring, I think, because back then we didn't really have cages. I mean, MMA was just starting, and the only cage out there was the USC. Everybody else, we all fought in rings. Boxing rings. And then we got to our feet. We stayed around on the ground for a little bit, and I ended up getting Matua with an armbar. Which worked out really good. And then
how about dealing with an adrenaline dump and getting ready to go into that second fight with fearless Lance Gibson?
That's the worst freaking thing ever at that point in my career. I mean, so we got to back up a little bit. So I was not sharing a back room with Danny Boy and Leonard, who were sharing a corner with Lance. Okay. Cause they were more tied in with Matt. And so I was sharing a ring and I don't remember his name. Probably the biggest Japanese dude or biggest Chinese guy. I mean, he was just yoked, whatever. Joey, you remember that guy's name? But anyway, Lance Gibson fought this dude, and this guy was so rocked up, and they did the whole 30 minutes of the round. And that guy came back, and this was, granted, this is my first big event. I'd flown somewhere. I'm preparing to fight. This is out of my backyard now. This is out of the Pacific Northwest, out of my comfort zone. And the guy I'm sharing a back court room with comes back after his fight looking like a different person. His face had more dots and more lumps than his body did. And that dude had the swole Greek god body. So, I mean, I was like, wow, fuck this. And then so I go out and I do my fight and it goes pretty well. And I come out pretty unscathed. And then I go back to the room and, you know, they've got that. There's only one bench or one table, you know. There's some places to sit, but it's like just one like massage table or doctor's table, if you will. And they're all checking this guy out, this, that, and the other, and doctoring him up because he's pretty beat up. And I came back after Matua and I told Mo, I go, look, dude, I got to fight again later. That guy's done. Like, get that guy out of here. So, of course, Maurice, big brother, he is, goes over and tells those guys to clear out so I can go up there and lay on that table and rest before the next fight. So just prepping. I got real lucky. I didn't expend a lot of energy on John. John, if I could characterize anybody as a Marvel character, he's kind of like the Beast, just a big guy and super smart. Once after the fight, that was my favorite part about fighting. When I'd win, I'd be the guy out there buying beers because I had more money. And I'd just sit there and get to talk to these guys like you've known each other for years. And John Matua was a really nice guy. So getting ready for the next fight, I was anxious, but I was calm because, again, I didn't take a lot of damage at all. So I was a little nervy because I didn't know who I was going up against. I mean, like I said earlier about having my gym, my students would Facebook stalk these one opponents. We didn't know who we were fighting. We couldn't look them up, and we had to fight more than one guy in the same night. So I feel we were more at that gladiator stage age than they are now, but the boxing commission got in, lightened it up. I mean, it's more sporty now. So that's good. People can, I guess, maybe fight longer. I don't know. I don't know why, but.
Ed, so in Hawaii, did you get a chance to hang out at all? Or was it just, were you guys just there and gone?
Pretty much. So here's my story I love to tell about that kind of shit. When you fly into anywhere and they pick you up with press, with limos, you're a big thing, you know, pretty girls, this and that. And then after you fight, the next day you wake up in some seedy hotel room, you got to find your own cab way on the way back. So to the airport, you know, if you're lucky to even have a flight home. So yeah, they treated us well. It was good, but sorry, what was the, yeah, say again.
So you flew back the next day. You didn't get to enjoy Hawaii.
Yeah, we got a day. I mean, maybe I got to see more when I went over there the year before with John Renfro than I did when I got to go over there and fight and Maurice was in my corner. Me and Mo was a lot more, he'd stick us on the training path. I mean, Maurice never smoked, drink, nothing. Maurice Smith is just straight as an arrow. So he just keep you right on the path all the time, hit all your press conferences, hit all your appointments, you know, and then traveling with him as well, he's getting drawn in several different directions while he's your coach. You know, he's got his interviews and his stuff to do. So we didn't get a whole lot of chance to get around the second time we were there.
You had mentioned, obviously, a close relationship with Maurice Smith. Were you there when he fought Mark Coleman?
Yes.
Oh, really?
Wow. Yeah, yeah. So that
were
was...
in his corner? Were you in his corner?
No. Believe it or not, out of the however many years me and Maurice were together, I never got to be in his corner. He and I fought at the same time often. So actually, my first big win was... Who did I fight? I fought Jason Farron up in Canada, came back with a black eye, and Mo had come back from fighting Mark Coleman with the opposite black eye. So we were, I met him at the airport, and he couldn't corner me that time because he was at the UFC while I was up fighting in Canada.
Okay. Okay. Well, you're also Josh Barnett's first opponent.
Yeah, that was another one of those Matt Hume setups.
Yeah, July 7th, 1997, you got Josh Barnett. Did you ever work out with Josh prior to this? Were you guys in the same room with each other?
We, Josh started with AMC right about the time we split. So there was some, maybe some very, very brief things in the very beginning. But at that point, I was quote unquote somebody at AMC finally, and Josh wasn't. So we didn't even go in the same training circles, if you will. Josh was an up and comer. But had I known then, Josh turned into one of the top dudes on the freaking planet.
Killer. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Straight killer. Yep.
So I got a question about this fight. I watched it last night. Did you guys fight under Pancrase rules with rope escapes? At one point, you guys were down in the corner. I was on a home video, so I couldn't hear a commentator. But did you guys fight with rope escapes?
So a lot of times that was the rule. If someone got too far out of the rope, that they would get stand up. Other fights, sometimes people would start using that to their advantage, which I did once exactly up in Canada. But in the Pancras rules, Matt didn't like that. So unless you were hanging out of the cage or off of the cage, he'd kind of let you fight into the ropes. Does that make sense? I mean,
what I meant was in Pancras, if somebody has a submission hold on you, you grab the rope, they would stand you up. That's not what it looked like happened.
Was it shooto? Oh, right. Was it shooto rules?
Yeah. So Matt didn't shooto let us rules. Do that. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, so shooto rules also has that rope escape as well. Oh. Yeah.
Yeah. So they didn't. I think in the beginning they gave us that kind of option, but no one really wanted to. I can't remember if I ever pulled that. Yeah. So I mean, I meant like as far as scooting under the ropes. I'm sorry.
Right.
I misunderstood.
Oh no, it's okay. And you take Josh Barnett to a decision, which is like in itself an incredible feat.
Okay. So that was when we met. We were both still amateurs, and that was no punching, only slaps to the head, punches to the body. I'm not sure if that was pro.
You guys were definitely amateur. Punching. You guys were definitely punching in this one. Yeah. Okay. And so you can kind of put the time frame together.
We met twice. Did. Yeah. The first time I can't remember. I don't think we were punching to the face. I think that was specifically like just slapping to the face and punching to the body, kind of like Pancras. And then we had to wear shin guards. And,
right.
Yeah. And then because we were in the shin guards, I don't even know if they counted that as pro. But they could have. That was right after my grandma had passed away. I hadn't been training for a while, but I kept the fight. My whole plan was go in there and kick him and knock him out with a head kick. And if you watch the fight, that's all I was trying to do was throw head kicks. And what'd Barnett do? He just, in Barnett style, just took me down every time. You know what I mean? And I pretty much set myself up for failure on that one. Again, it was, I felt when quote unquote Pancras was coming out in the Pacific Northwest, Matt was pretty much putting the rules together and doing all this. And after my first couple of striking encounters with, some of his, fighters, the rules seemed to change a little bit and take away one of my best weapons, which was my fist, and turn it into slaps and then kicks, you know? And that was the second time I met Barnett. I ended up getting DQ'd, cause I was late and I got to the fighters meeting. It was after I'd fought in Brazil. I was feeling all cocky I walked into the fighters meeting. I go, I got one question. Can I punch? They said, yes. I said, fine. I walked out. Well, apparently you could not close fist punch from the ground. So that was the DQ. So again, we go out second time with Barnett. I try to exchange. Barnett takes me down real quick. Barnett's phenomenal on the ground. That guy's so big and smooth with it all. And I wrapped him up in the guard, and I just started lighting him up from my guard. He sat up, like kind of, and looked over at Matt Hume. Matt Hume was looking at him. The ref wasn't doing anything. I looked at Maurice. Maurice was yelling, hit him again. So I pulled him in with my legs and hit him again. Then the ref stopped it, and I was DQ'd. Found out later I couldn't closed fish punch from the ground. So it was one of those things where I felt, again, taking away my strikes was not the best thing.
You know, the thing is, at this time, the state's getting involved and shutting shows down.
Yeah.
So in order to kind of tap dance around their rules, as well as, you know, get your guys some fights and experience, oftentimes you had to resort to open fist on the ground.
Right. Well, and knowing all that now, it makes total sense. But back then it was, I took it as a personal, oh, you know, he's just trying to take away my, you know, this, yeah, that, and the other. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Of course.
You know, because when you're young, you know everything.
So on July 26, 1997, it's an event that's called Raw Combat. In our interview with Lee Remedios, he says it's a closed door biker event, invite only, and you're fighting Jason Farron. And I mean, when you walk into there, when did you start doing the maths and start saying to yourself, yeah, this isn't on the up and up?
When we crossed the border. So Canada, right? We'd go up there sometimes, and I don't know. Again, ignorant kid. I base everything off my ignorance. You know, us Americans are pretty ignorant people, but we're very outspoken. And so I base that off myself. And going up there, sometimes you go up there, it's put on like the Blaisdell Arena. There's crowds, there's people, it's all legit. And other times you'd go up there and all you have is a piece of paper or a CD piece of paper with an address on it. You go there, there's a guy in a trench coat. He hands you another piece of paper with a CD address on it. You go there, meet another guy, and you're like three or four stops in before you arrive at an actual venue. And then it's like a warehouse place. And it's like, again, this closed door thing, invite only. So yeah, from first CD guy, trench coat guy, I mean, pretty much going across the border, we knew something wasn't right in our, you know. And so we go through the chain of getting there, and you know, so they can divert people or however it is. We get there. It's like this abandoned warehouse type deal. We go back. We luckily, I had John Renfro with me, Pat Hawk. Royman Rotberg was fighting as well. Lonnie Canada out of my camp was fighting. These were all my training partners and stuff. So we were rolling deep. And back then, we all were tough cookies. We weren't too afraid of nothing, ignorant. And so we get there, and not only is it CD there, they did the whole fight card in reverse. Me and Farron were the first fight because they didn't know how many fights they'd get off before the cops busted it. So
they start with the main event.
They started with the main event and worked backwards.
Okay. And I'll tell you what, like in this day and age, I was only able to attend like one event. It wasn't crazy like you're speaking of, but we're moving the main event up because we don't know how long we're going to be here. That's why everybody's here. Yeah. And then like, and then it went for biggest ticket seller after that, all the way down. Yeah.
How did an event like this pay? I'm curious.
Well, see, back then, again, like we talked about that earlier, we were freaking happy in the amateurs if they gave us per diem. Like if we got 20 Canadian dollars to freaking throw in on a, and this
loonies.
Is again, my,
they call you them
know,
loonies.
Yeah, loonies, yeah, and toonies. Yeah. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, and this is my ignorant ass. I go up there. I'm like, can I get a Canadian bacon and pineapple pizza? They're like, you mean ham and pineapple? I'm like, no, Canadian bacon. you know? Yeah, freaking retarded. All right. So they have to explain to me, you're in Canada, sir. Okay. All right. I get it now. All right. So so the just to get per diem to go up to these fights to pay for your gas, because like you said earlier, we were paying to fight. We had to pay for our own travel. We had no doctors, no nothing. You know, if you got your ass whooped, hopefully your buddy would drive you home, you know.
Or fake name at the hospital.
Yeah. You know, I luckily never had to go that far. But then, so Farron, what did he pay? And so the way they announced it, and that's what I love about that fight. And I use that fight a lot because they were announcing it like, oh, these two athletes have been training since they're 6 years old. Motherfucker. Yep. You know what I mean? I didn't start until I was like 19. You know what I mean? It's just total lies. They completely build up Farron. Apparently I was the quote unquote warm-up fight for Frank Shamrock, who was one of my coaches at the time, as they were, you know, as Maurice was making the alliance or creating the alliance with TK and Frank. So, I was the warm-up fight. So the whole commentary of these guys is phenomenal. That it just cracks me up. I have such a good time with that. Just such bullshit. But that was great. I mean, going out against Farron and not, you know, being in a seedy little place like that, and then whooping his ass. And then that was my first, he gave me my first legit black eye with a big old headbutt. So when I came back with that black eye, Mark Coleman had given one to Maurice, you know, so we were like, oh, we'd always play off that we were twins, you know, because both bald, whatever. Yeah, there is a bit skin difference, but we'd play it off. So, but yeah, so that was phenomenal. And then a couple more fights, then they started working their way down the chain, and my buddy Roman fought his guy for a half hour, which was funny. They were, at one point, if you see the whole card, they were clinched. They were just exhausted. The ref separated them. They went to the upper corners. And then they both walked out to the middle and just hugged each other again, held on like they were dancing. It was they're just watching people fight to pure exhaustion was phenomenal. And so you don't get to see that kind of stuff these days.
So at this event, Jason Farron, obviously you win KO knees. Very loose rules, you know, oftentimes, rules are applied to the visiting person, but the hometown guy kind of gets a little different, a little more leeway in regards to it. But Jason Farron, he's kind of, I'm not going to say he's a controversial figure, but he's one of those guys that kind of had that TMA bravado, but represented himself as an MMA guy, obviously UFC veteran as well. How would you describe him?
We were supposed to meet previously at the Blaisdell Arena for the Canadian Shoot Fighting Championship. When we got there, the promoter only had one set of 4-ounce MMA gloves. We decided that neither one of us would wear gloves. Jason found out I knew a little bit about grappling. I was with Matt Hume back then, and left in his IROC Z28. So that's how I encapsulate Jason Farron. He's all show. I mean, he's a decent athlete. I mean, he's got people that go to his gym and he trains them, but when it comes to the real fight, he don't want any part of that.
I had heard a rumor that he challenged you to a fight with glass on your knuckles. Was there any truth to that?
That okay. So that was backstage at that same thing.
Okay.
Before or after you beat him up?
Oh no. So this was the first encounter where he left at the Blaisdell Arena, because again, we were backstage. And, you know, it was a problem not having two pairs of MMA gloves. And then finally Maurice steps up and goes, let's take the gloves off. And then Farron spouted up, I'll fight you with glass on my knuckles. And 20 minutes later, when the fights are happening and then they go to announce us to come out, no one could find Farron. He had left.
Oh. Tail light. Yeah, I heard about that. I heard about that. He's an interesting guy. He's an interesting guy. Yeah, I've heard he's passed. I went on like a Jason Farron deep dive after the whole glass knuckle thing. And I couldn't find much on him. I know he's passed away. That's about it. Let's talk about your invite, February 7th, 1998.
Oh, I didn't know he passed away. I'm sorry.
There's very little on him. February 7th, 1998, you get invited to Brazil. Sergio Bottarelli is the promoter. International Valley Tudo Championship. You're also in another tournament there. You're in an eight-man tournament.
Eight-man tournament, and that's where I got to meet some of the most, Mike Van Elsdell was on that card. Tim Catalfo was on that card. There's so many phenomenal fighters on that card. And so it was an honor to be there. And Sergio treated us all like kings. And my trip to Brazil really put a lot of things in perspective to me, because at the time for a job, like I was, flipping Section 8 houses and mobile homes and stuff like that for construction. And I'd go into these people's home and they just ruin them. And I'd go over to Brazil and you got a family of six living in a cardboard shanty that are happy, and grateful and good, versus the American entitlement. That's when my views on the world really started changing. And so we go over there. Sergio puts us up in a phenomenal hotel. One of my favorite things was going down in the morning for breakfast. All you could eat buffet, but the fruit coming out of freaking Brazil. I mean, I felt like really
the Amazon. Amazon.
Oh. I was like, the snozzberries taste like snozzberries. I was just, it was so delicious. And so, man, we just grub. And then that was my first experience with drinking out of a coconut and all that kind of Sao Paulo, Brazil. Really, I mean, what? I think it was one at the time, like one of the fifth largest cities on the planet. It's just huge. And then you go out there and just tons of street kids, and you learn so much about the world traveling. And that was my favorite part about MMA and the opportunities it gave me, was opening my eyes to the real world and seeing other countries and different stuff. But so Sergio treated us great. We get there, we get to the venue. It's in the hotel. They've got these weird glass things hanging from the ceiling. It just looks like a trip. We get out there. Granted, so this is my first International Valley Tudo. So it was awesome, but no gloves. And I'm a striker. So I didn't realize that we wear gloves for a reason. You hit somebody so many times with your hand now looks like one of those 5-ounce MMA gloves. So we go out there, no rules. The first guy I come across is Jesus. I tell everyone I beat up Jesus. Jesus something de Silva, I think. And, I was undefeated in my younger career, and I was doing really good. And this is pre-UFC.
Just to set the record straight, it's Lucas Silva de Jesus. Sorry, go ahead.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And so we scrap it out real quick. Great specimen. Again, probably looked like he was a good training partner, but didn't like getting punched. And once I got him on the ground, started hitting him, he tapped out pretty quick. So again, going pretty fresh into the second round. I was feeling pretty good, but going into the second round, my next guy, Dario Amorim,
who would just beat up Jason Godsey in the first
round. Which absolute savage, Jason Godsey.
But, but I had no idea and how his fight went or how fresh he was coming out. But at that point in my life, I had never hit somebody so many times, so hard, and not had an effect. And that dude would not go down. I had nothing left. I mean, I think I was like halfway in, 15 minutes in or something, because that dude kept, I got kneed in the balls, even with a cup on. I got kneed in the nuts more in that night than most people do in their entire life. And that's where they introduced me into foot stomping. The thing is with foot stomping, I mean, Dario was a very, very dirty fighter. And that was my first experience with that. halfway through the fight, I looked over at Maurice and I'm like, I was just feeling sick. I'm like, I want it out. I knew I couldn't do anything else. I'm like, I'm going to get sick. He's like, so get sick. Like, Mo, don't let nobody quit. So, I knew I wasn't getting out of there until I finished him. So we battled it out for all 30 minutes. That was my first big loss, but yet I got more, kudos from more fighters in the fight game for that loss over any of my wins. Yeah. Marco, wow. Marco Huas later. I mean, people that I looked up to, like, hey, I saw your fight in Brazil. Good job. I mean, fighters respect fighting, you know, not
locker room. Yeah. It's that locker room respect. Yeah. Like you can sit here and look at social media likes and how many thumbs up you get, but that locker room respect, there's no faking that. There's no faking that at all.
Nah.
Yeah. Joey, when do you first encounter Bob Gilstrap?
It was 2001, give or take a year. I'm driving on the 605 freeway, which in California, that's a major freeway. And, this crazy guy pulls up next to me. I'm driving a little truck and starts yelling something about wanting to fight me. And I had a girlfriend in the car, so I couldn't look like a punk. I pull off to the side and who jumps out of their car? But the guy that I just watched fight in the IVC, Bob Gilstrap. He had seen my tap out sticker and my submission factory sticker. And he was looking for a place to train. I've never felt so relieved in my life. I was like, oh my God, I'm going to get murdered on the side of the road. You know, I'm a lifelong wrestler, but I don't want to go fight a UFC vet.
No.
But that's how I met him. Haven't spoke to him since, but that's my memory of meeting Bob. He was looking for a place to train, and I was with Larry Lambis's Submission Factory at the time.
So Bob, your side of the story was, Joey driving like a total jagoff, and you had to check him.
You had to put me in my place.
What happened? Now, what's your side of that story?
Honestly, I mean, again, like we talked about in the beginning, us three have been around forever. And back then, now there's a freaking Gracie Barra or something on every freaking corner down here. So, you just didn't have gyms, you know? So that was the whole thing. I was down here and I needed a spot to train. It was the same thing. Like I'd go out to Vegas and make phone calls to Maurice and, you know, like, oh, so-and-so's got a gym here. I just show up, you know, do a drop-in fee. You're just always looking to fight. I mean, that's staying fresh. I mean, it was exciting back then. You wanted that edge. And so, yeah, I was always just looking for a place to go.
It was such a small subculture back in the day that, yeah, if you ran into a guy with a tap out sticker, you had a new friend. Nobody else could talk to you about the subject, you know?
No. Yeah. It was a hush subject. You know what I mean? And back you'd have to explain it to people, like we said in the beginning, and you know, then people look at y'all, you mean like human cockfighting? No, we're both competitors. We're both trained for this. This is our choice. You know, but people had no idea. So it was a very small subculture. And then being at parties or being around family, you always run into the guy, Joe, you know this, that, oh, I've got a sister's cousin's brother knows this guy whose dog shits in his yard. He can kill you with two punches.
Two fingers.
Yeah. You know, or this, I've got this guy, you know, oh, my cousin, he's in that. And I'm like, but back then I'm like, okay, what's his name? They'd say, I'm like, no, he's not. You know, because if I don't fucking know him, he ain't nobody. Like, there's only a few of us.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, everybody knew each other. And it was like, so he's from our area and I don't know his name and he's doing this. I'm at these events every weekend. Is that what you're telling me? Okay.
Yeah.
It's one of those situations. So UFC 17, obviously you make your UFC debut May 15th, 1998. How do you get the call? Is this John Peretti or is it Art Davies still?
To be honest, I don't know. I want to say Art, but
I think John was like kind of hanging around, right around there, but I think it was still Art. Yeah,
it's like I remember meeting Joe Rogan backstage at the Hawaiian Super Brawl before, you know, he was even part of the UFC. So like we were there when it started. So that's what's really cool about being a pioneer of the fastest growing, the biggest, you know, sport and all that kind of stuff. But so the reason Maurice and AMC split was due to management issues. My manager at the time, Kurt, he took the call. I didn't even know. I was just told, hey, you've got X amount of time. You're going to go fight in the UFC. The problem with that at this point, they're like, we got you in, but there was only two weight classes back then, 200 and down and 200 and up. Well, like I said earlier, my body, I'd been 220 pounds since the fifth grade. So I had to get me to cut weight. So 2 weeks out of the UFC, I'm at 198 pounds. I'm lean. I'm riding my bike. I roll my mountain bike, dislocate my shoulder. For 2 weeks, I can do nothing but stationary bike. I can't even grapple. I can't do nothing. Maurice tells me, he goes, hey, look, you can't pull out this UFC. He goes, you pull out, they're not calling back. So I went with Maurice. We flew to Mobile, Alabama for UFC 17. Right when we got off the plane, I had a sauna suit on since 4 a.m. that morning. I was taking water retention pills. We went and hit every cardio machine, played basketball, swam, did everything we could. And I lost 14 pounds in a day to make weight for the UFC. And then fought the next day and did not do well at all.
Well, Carlos Newton is your opponent. How was your interaction with Carlos?
Carlos came off as very arrogant, and to me, with all the fights that I'd done and the behind the scenes and the backstage and the after parties, I always kind of, I was more of a partier than say Maurice, but I liked the way the winners held themselves a certain way and were respectful to their opponents. And Carlos did not come off of a person that way. I was always kind to my guys. I'd buy some beers. I'd, you know, hey, let's talk, this and that. Carlos came off as a very push-off kind of way. And so he was the only guy I wished I could have fought again at 100%, you know. So, and again, with the MMA and the fight, and you're supposed to keep your emotions out of it. But I got
Bob, let me ask you, was he a dick? Yes or no?
Yeah, he is a prick.
Okay. So yeah. I'm not going to pile on, but I will say he refuses to respond to our interview requests. That's all I'm saying.
I'll tell you this. I heard he got stabbed up in Canada for breaking up a fight. I'm like, serve you right, you prick.
But this whatever. Is Bob Gilstrap, everybody.
An incredibly stacked card, by the way. It's Frank Shamrock and Jeremy Horn, Mark Coleman and Pete Williams, Tank, Hugo Dorte, Van Arsdale. I mean, this is a very stacked event.
The guys I had the opportunity to compete with and our era were some of the legendary guys. I mean, it was great. Like
cream of the crop. 100%. Absolutely. Yeah.
And so
no faking it. There was no faking it.
Mm-mm. These were real dudes. There was no smack talk on the internet. There was no bullshit. Everyone was cool. And so like even cutting weight for that, the last couple pounds, I was fatigued. Mo was like, all right, you're into the sauna or the steam room. Sends me in there. And Mark Coleman, I go in there for a while. I pop out. It's Maurice. I go in there for a while, pop out, check my weight, that kind of stuff. He put me back in there. Then I pop out one time. And there's Mark Coleman, Mark. All these guys are sitting on the bench with Maurice just chatting it up, waiting for me to make weight, you know. And it's like, that's cool as shit. You know what I mean? It was almost like I wanted to stop and take a picture or, you know, take all that in or get some autographs of other guys that I hadn't met yet, but Maurice had. But here I'm trying to cut weight and I keep coming out and I'm bitching like a little girl, man. I'm like, man, this thing is so hot. I'm like, there's something wrong. I can't breathe. And Mo's like, I don't want to hear it. You got 2 more pounds, or I don't want
to hear it. That's a wrong crew to look for sympathy with.
And so I went, and of course, Mo you know, and I'm coming out and all these guys, these big old men, and I'm all sucked up and just whining. I can't, it's too hot. And then, you know, and then he just keeps pushing me back in there. And then when I finally make weight, I come out and I just lay down on the cold tile floor, and they're all laughing at me. And sure as shit, right then, here comes the maintenance guy with his bucket of tools, goes, "You weren't just in there, were you? That thing's broken." And I'm like, I had no, I'm like, and they all just erupted laughter and take,
yeah,
you know, no pity, no pity.
No, funny, like, funny. Ah! Great joke. Yeah. Great joke.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. First, yeah. Covered first degree burns, you know, head to toe.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny. You make your way back up to Canada for Western Canada's toughest March 18, 2000. Gary arm burst. Here's the thing about the Golden Boy. He's got an extensive boxing background. He's got phenomenal submissions. Ends his career at 6-0. Like, there's like, out of the old school cats, he's on my short list of why didn't he make it to the UFC?
Right. Yeah, I lost that one by decision.
You got a hell of a chin, because that guy can crack.
Yeah, that was a good fight. I mean, I wasn't happy with the, you know, the call at the end, but we did do some exchanging and stuff like that. So I was just, yeah, I wasn't happy off, you know, coming off that UFC loss and all that kind of stuff as well. So
you'd mentioned Frank Shamrock. Do you have any Frank Shamrock stories, or what was it like being in the gym with them?
Frank was more close with Maurice, of course, and then my other buddy, John Renfro. So again, Frank, we had that more teacher-student relationship versus buddies. And he pushed, but the thing is, having the chance to train between both Frank and Ken Shamrock, Ken to me is just like a toothless silverback gorilla. He's one of the strongest guys. He just manhandles you. And the first guy that chokes us all out with a triangle choke. But Frank, I liked his fluidity, his different fighting style. So I tried to be more like Frank. And so I just didn't have, you know, that Greek bod that Frank's got. The Greek bod, yeah.
TK Kosaka, how was his English?
Not bad. Not the worst. I mean, it was a bit broken. TK, you know, back then taught us what we called the TK guard for the alliance, which, you know, you transitions over to jiu-jitsu as the butterfly guard. It was a phenomenal intro to our game. TK, man, TK was a phenomenally class act. He was always polite, always a strong training partner. Probably one of the biggest Japanese dudes I've ever met. He got an offer. Remember that show, that American Gladiators show? I guess he got an offer. Yeah, he got an offer to be on that show and turned it down. And then later, when I got to go fight in Japan, TK was one of the guys running the fight gyms over there. Over there, all the fighters live with you. They cook. I mean, everything's in the house. So, yeah, I just love TK. He was such a good person.
All right. So TK, Frank Shamrock leaves Lion's Den. He goes out with Maurice Smith. They form the alliance. TK goes with him. Jerry Bolander, Pete Williams stay at the Lion's Den. But TK and Frank at one point were absolutely, I mean, obviously Frank, but TK was also in the Lion's Den. TK's UFC fight was against Pete Williams. Was that like an intentional setup between Frank and Ken to put their students against each other?
To be honest, I don't know. Because again, I was like the, if they were the, you know, starting lineup, I was the B string. You know, I was the up and comer. I was the training partner. So all the logistical stuff wasn't even handled. I mean, I was so ignorant. My first contract I signed was for 33%. I didn't realize coach standards were 15%, you know, or 10%. I locked into a 10-year deal at 33 and a third.
With who? With who?
With Kirk. You know, that was I yeah.
Kirk who?
Jensen was my Kirk. Was my yeah. He was my manager. But the thing is, he was more.
Wait. Kirk Jensen or Kirk Jensen?
Kirk Jensen.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. And he was Maurice's manager as well, and as well as Bambi. She was a female fighter and a couple of, but Kirk pretty much spent his time. Kirk hated for the most part. I was the black sheep of the group, you know, out partying, kicking it up, didn't watch my mouth or whatever. And Kirk had his own agenda, and I was lucky that I even got the fights that I did. It's not like he made phone calls for me or anything, to my knowledge. I mean, people called looking specifically for me because of word of mouth or found out about me. I made the worst. Again, I was an ignorant little redneck coming out of the country. I didn't know. I just wanted to beat people up. And I was just training there one day, and they're like, "Hey, you're doing pretty good through the amateurs. You keep doing what you're doing, we're going to pay you." And I was like, "All right." So I signed anything anybody put in front of me. I don't know.
Hey, what's going to end with this one? Jeff Monson, AMC, Return of the Gladiators, July 29th, 2000. Jeff, did he look enhanced standing across the room from you? just out of curiosity.
Either that or he had just gotten a fight with a whole hornet's nest, and those were a bunch of stings because he was swelled. That guy, so enhanced, so big, so strong, shorter than me, but in his I give credit to anybody's athleticism. That guy had an ankle pick further away than any other person. I normally can get a knee or an uppercut. I can get some sort of strike on a wrestler. I had nothing on fucking Jeff. He was under my knee by the time he was within striking distance.
He's able to like ride the ground at such a low level for an incredible distance. Yes.
It's fucking amazing. Yes. It was amazing.
I agree with that.
He hit me with it all night long. I didn't get one shot off on him. And he just held my legs. And I just kept teeing off on the top of it or side of his head. He kept trying to hide his head. So I'd have to hit the top. Then I'd have to switch to the other arm. Because that was a thing back then, to eliminate the striker. You know, you had the submission. You had the you could grab the ring back in the day. Well, after a while, hitting the back of the head was illegal. So as soon as you hit somebody, they just turn their head, so you'd be hitting the back, and then they turn to the other side. You know, so but the whole time I'm hitting him, I was talking to him, "Let me up, Jeffrey," and he'd look up at me and grin and smile and hide his head again. You know. And then the ref would stand us up, and I'd try something. That guy'd be on the carpet, and I'd be on my back, you know, and I'd "Let me up, Jeffrey," you know, and he'd smile. And so it just went on like that until it was over, and he got the W. So great.
At one point in this fight, he's on top of you. The ref breaks it up, and they let him go back to his corner. It looked like they either had an issue with his glove or they were letting him relocate a dislocated finger. Do you have any memory of that?
I don't remember. I couldn't see what they were doing. I was probably gasping for air my own self, you know.
It looked like they let him realign a dislocated finger, which, you know, if I were you, I'd be mad about.
Right. Well, yeah, and that's just, I mean, if you, well, and you, Joey, you watched my fights up in Canada against Farron as well. Like, I don't know why it was, why all the guys I fight get breaks in the corner and shit. Like, in the Farron fight, I had to go get him, you know?
Bob, if you were to break bad on Jeff, he's now a Russian citizen. He's not coming back to this country. I mean, by all means, you can say whatever it is you want with no repercussion.
Now, Jeff, again, he came from around the same area. Like, me and Hallman went to the same high school. Jeff was from Olympia. I talked to Jeff. Jeff used to, like, "What do you do for fun?" I like, "What's an anarchist do?" Like, you know, I didn't fucking know. Like, what do you do? You know, like, what's
steroids?
Oh, we, Hang out
at Starbucks, you know
it's like, oh, we go down to the Capitol and spray paint shit. I'm like, wow, big man. You know what I mean? Like, hey, is that making a difference? So like we get these talks. Jeff got a little crazy there after a while and then took off. Well, I ran into him again, in a fight in Washington State when I was traveling through, and, I went back into his corner and he was laying down, and, I pulled him up and gave him a hug and said, hey, good to see you. But he went out, I guess he was on the Russian circuit at that point. He was fighting every week. The guy just fought himself into the ground.
He actually fought like 6 years with one eye in our, there's a couple things here. So our Jeff Monson interview is absolutely crazy. Like, I would have approached it a little different now because our formula is a little different now than it was then, but it was just kind of us kind of getting this together. He fought for multiple years with one eye. His relationship, you had mentioned Dennis Hallman going to high school with Dennis. What was that like?
Dennis was a cocky little kid, had a really cute older sister that was in my grade. Ran into Hallman once in the locker room playing football. I think I was a junior. He was a freshman talking shit, and I had to punch him then. But he was just always a very, I mean, he was always a phenomenal wrestler. I mean, he had a reason to be confident, but, you know, I draw the line at arrogance. You know what I mean? When you're, if you need to put people down to make yourself feel better, I got a fucking problem with you. You know, that's all there is to it. And he was one of those kind of people.
Well, high school. Yeah, we're talking high school. But he and Jeff Monson, it's a relationship where we got Dennis Hallman on, and the majority of our interview is confirming the stories that we had gathered in previous interviews. And Dennis essentially is going, yep, that happened. Yep, that happened. are you aware of him and Jeff Monson's relationship?
I know. I just heard rumors. I heard rumors.
How crazy it was.
I mean, fighting at parties, fighting everywhere. Everyone's fighting.
Moving furniture up on his roof, including his cat, stuff like that.
I didn't hear any of that.
Yeah. Oh, dude. All right. Frank Shamrock, when he came over from, you know, to form the Alliance. All right. If I'm going to recommend one interview for like the old school cats, it's Tony Galindo, like the Lion's Den tell all. Right. Did Frank ever come back with like, yeah, then Ken got ripped off by this gay porn star for about 30 grand in ecstasy. And then, you know, he beat up Pete Williams. And, you know, did they ever talk about stuff like that? Or Tony Vernon White outside of a bar because he's banging his wife, anything like that?
If he did, it wasn't to me. He was more with Maurice and John. Me and Frank were not that tight.
Damn.
Yeah, sorry. I got a good one about UFC 17 though. So here's Boss Rutan. So Boss is there. So is Tank Abbott. Boss, I fucking love Boss. And then this is after. Was this pre or after Maurice had beat Tank? I'm pretty sure it was after. So Tank was a little bit more humble. And Tank went up in the elevator earlier that day with me and Maurice. And one-on-one, that dude was a half bad guy. He was a nice guy. He wasn't this shit-talking guy that everyone told about. After the UFC, I don't see him again. After the UFC transpires, I'm out there. I'm hanging with Art Davey or, you know, all these guys and Boss Rutan and all these guys. And of course, Maurice doesn't go out and drink, but so I'm out with these guys and having a good time and me and, you know, whatever. And I walk across the dance floor to go get another beer and Tank's out with all of his cronies right there. And Tank's got to act tough in front of all of his guys. So I go walking by, he grabs me. And this is before I knew that, well, I don't know for true, but I heard he was gay. I don't fucking know. I don't know anything. You know, it's people were studying that shit. But anyway, Tank grabs me by the hips and kind of does the show dominance thing, like he's riding me from behind. I kind of, I break away. I'm like, ha ha, you know, whatever. I go walk and I grab my beer. and then go back to the, you know, our group or whatever.
At least he could do is buy the beer. I mean,
So then a little bit later, Tank goes walking by and I grab Tank and I pull him into me and I give him the little, you know, and his cronies don't like that. And Tank kind of smiles and giggles, right? And it got a sheepish grin, but then all his boys come up and like, you ain't going to let him get away with this shit. You ain't, you know? And so they're pushing us to fight. So here I'm in this dance club bar thing. And at this point, Boss Rutan had left, and went. So, and so I didn't have anybody but promoters with me, no fighters. And, Tank's about to take flight on me, and one-on-one with Tank, I'm like, okay, I'll be able to do this, but like, I can't fight this whole group of people. Then all of a sudden I feel this hand on my shoulder and this beautiful bald head pops out of nowhere. He'd been gone for about an hour and he's got his Dutch accent. He's like, all right, Tank, we going to do this shit or what? You know, and Boss Rutan's got my back and all of his cronies kind of just took off after that. And back, Boss saved my life once again. So there was a good one with Boss. We had a good night that night.
Boss, known for his partying. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. So Maurice Smith, when was the last time you talked to him?
We talk usually around his birthday every year. If I don't talk to him about 2 or 3 times a year,
we've been trying to get him on forever, man.
Well, and like,
why?
He won't even go on the podcast that I co-host sometimes on weekends, you know, and talk on and just does an interview. He won't do nothing unless he gets paid.
Define
paid.
I don't know. I never asked it. He's like, Bob, I ain't doing nothing. I get paid. I'm like, he wouldn't even, when I had my gym out in Colorado for 5 years, I kept like, hey, come out here. This would be great. Nah. He's like, he'd send me I'll do it for this amount. Like, I ain't paying you to come out.
Wow.
So,
yeah. All those punches you took from him, that should be worth something.
Yeah, something. Some sort of little gratuity, you know.
Well, here, let's plug your podcast. What podcast do you occasionally host on the weekends?
It's called Fighting Words. It's on. To be honest with you guys, like, I don't even know how to get on a podcast. I just started looking you guys up, and this the other one. I'm an Android user, not an iPhone guy. So I'm not a huge podcast guy, and I tell people about it, and I rarely can even find it myself. But
say it again. It's fight what?
Fighting. So it doesn't have the G.
Okay.
Fighting Words, and it's on. Fighting Words Google, podcast.
Google Play, Apple, iTunes, all that stuff.
Yeah, it's on one of those things. Okay. And then it's more of a boxing podcast. Again, I was kind of like the way I met Joey is I was at a bar in D.C. 5-6 years ago, ear hustling a conversation because they were talking about boxing. And I'm like, hey, like, of course, I spout up, you know, and jump into some people I don't even know. Hey, start talking MMA and this and that. And they're like, oh, hey, we know this guy. We do a soccer podcast, but the guy that does it, he does an MMA podcast. Would you go on as a guest star or a guest speaker? And that was 6 years ago. Five. It was right after the Jorge Masvidal Ben Askren fight where he took that knee. You know, they brought me on and I was like, well, you got to, you know, I explained who they both were. And then, you know, Ben talking shit coming over from his other organization. He Ben Askren for it. So, and then they just keep calling. They won't stop calling.
Okay. Fair enough. Bob Gilstrap, brother, although you met Joey on the side of the road, about 2 decades ago, Joey's been mentioning you in regards to putting you on a podcast. We looked at your record a few times, and then our buddy Hong Kong Fui from the underground forum, mixedmartialarts.com. Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to interact with, like, if you're here at this time right now, you're like a mentally ill fight fan, I highly recommend you guys sign up for the underground forum, mixedmartialarts.com. It is just a group of people just like us, awesome. Where we all gather. So, Bob, sincerely appreciate your time. And we'll be sending you a YouTube link so you can send this to your friends once we get it up.
All right, hey, buddy. Guys, it was a pleasure. Thank you very much. I appreciate you guys, and I appreciate what you do.
Absolutely. Thank you, Bob. Thanks, brother.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. God bless.
Joey.
Another one in the record books.
Yeah, you've been talking about him for over a year.
I didn't realize I've been talking about him that much, but I'm glad I finally locked him down. Scary encounter finally paid off.
You know what I mean? But think about like your headspace. You're going to get out of the car on a highway?
Well, like I said, okay, so I got a girlfriend sitting next to me who hears me talk about MMA, and I'm training MMA all the time, and I'm going to bitch out. No, I can't have my punk card pulled. So yeah, I followed him to the side of the road, and I was very grateful that he just wanted to train with me. Dude. It's a good way to get shot, actually. And by the way, I mean, in this scenario, I am 22 years old and I'm an idiot. So would I do that today? Probably not.
You know what? It's just like, you got to look at her and you say, babe, today I woke up and chose violence. We're pulling over. We're pulling over. We're going to see what this is all about. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was cool, man. I'm glad he came on, you know, he's still sharp. You know, he had a hell of a career, fought some big names, and, you know, I'm glad we knocked this one out.
100%. So, ladies and gentlemen, like, share, subscribe. You guys got to do that. We had a really good 2023. We grew by 70%. You know, we're currently looking for somebody to help head up a producer for us. We definitely need some help. Booking guests, clips, thumbnails, stuff like that. Otherwise, I mean, Joey, it's just me. And you and Andrew, there's a guy named Anthony Shears. He doesn't do much, but Andrew Mendoza.
He's part of the group, allegedly. I keep hearing about him.
Yeah, yeah. So if you guys want to come over and help us, just figure out what it is you can do. This is a passion project. I know, Joey, in the next couple months, I'm going to be heading out to California. I'm expecting to take a few lefts and rights from your wife in regards to this.
I told her if we stay the course, this is going to make us dozens of dollars.
Yes,
dozens.
Right. So please like, share, subscribe. We can't do this without you. MixedMartialArts.com is also a phenomenal gathering place if you're into stuff like this. So Joey, I'll see you in a couple months. And I think we got Herb Dean right around the corner. Anybody else?
He'll be coming on. That's the only one I got right now. The Punisher said he would do it this winter, and it is winter. Jason.
Oh, the Alessio?
No. He's got a knocked out win over Babalu.
Oh, Jason. Oh, Canadian cat, right? You're talking about the Canadian guy?
And a loss to Marco Huas. And his name is escaping me at the moment, which I hope he doesn't see this clip because.
Yeah, Jeff Curran. I also got Jeff Curran. He's going to be really good for some fantastic stories. Jeff Curran, I think we're going to record him beginning of next week. I got to get a hold of Lytle. He's going to sit in on that one. I don't know. The list is kind of getting short right now. We got to start making Luigi Fiavarante. I got him lined up. That's a good guy out of California.
Rafael Italians Torre, are always a good guest.
Rafael,
a lot Torre, of character, charisma.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Rafael Torre, training partner. Gerald Strevens, training partner as well. So he's going to have a little insight into that. I think I'm either going to, I got to hook up with Mike Brown at the end of the month over at American Top Team, hoping, you know, I can kind of cherry pick some of the guys from over there as well. So we're going to get it. We're going to get it going. So ladies and gentlemen, you got friends or family that, might be good guests here, hit us on our inbox through Instagram. That's the best way to get a hold of us. Joey, until next time.
I'll talk to you in about an hour. Bye.
Yeah. Be good.
Check out the full interview on iTunes, Spotify, and all major podcast platforms.